Thank you for downloading this episode of Software Gone Wild, a podcast focused on everything software-defined. To get more episodes and explore other SDN and network automation resources, visit sdn.ipspace.net.
In spring 2016, Cisco released a new switch in the Nexus 9000 series where they claimed in some blog posts that they stopped using the merchant silicon and went back to their own ASICs. It was time to figure out what's really going on behind the scenes, and Lucas Krattiger from Cisco was kind enough to join me in this short podcast where we'll go deep into the architecture of so-called cloud ASIC. Thank you, Lucas, for being with me.
Thank you very much, Ivan, for having me.
I know that a lot of people know you from your VXLAN discussions. For the three listeners who don't, what are you doing at Cisco?
From the VXLAN discussions, yes, probably some of you guys know me from there, yes. At Cisco, I'm what we call a principal engineer. I'm working out of the technical marketing group in what was formerly in CME, today what we call it in INSBU, and we're focusing very strongly on data center architectures. Over the years, I did so many different things. VXLAN was one of them, the most recent thing. But I was actually working previously in service provider as well as working for Cisco Partner to implement networks or build networks, design networks, as also operate networks. So it's really that coming from the outside and bringing an inside view into product marketing and product development, it's something that was pretty excited for me to do there. So that's where I am right now. And ACI and VXLAN is on my pace, yes.
Okay, Cisco launched the 9300
EX, correct.
And that totally confused me because the table sizes didn't match any table sizes I've seen anywhere else in the industry. They were similar to what Arista is doing with Jericho, but somehow things didn't match. And then I found out that you're using your own ASICs and you call them cloud scale ASICs.
That's correct. Yes. So we have the Cisco Nexus 9200, as well as the Cisco Nexus 9300EX, which are completely based on Cisco custom ASIC. So there is not a merchant ASIC in there as what we had in the Nexus 9300 previously, where we had a tag teaming between a Broadcom merchant silicon, the Triton 2 in that case, and Cisco ASIC, which we also had in there to complement the merchant. Now with the Cisco Cloud Scale ASIC, we went, I don't want to say back, but we did a parallel path to all the merchant efforts we're doing. And that's true. Yes, you will not be able to compare them to a Jericho or to a Trident or Tomahawk-like ASIC on one-on-one pair, but there are similarities in where they fit in from a use case perspective.
So why did you guys decide to go back to developing your own ASICs?
Well, did we went back or did
well,
we never
stopped?
It?
Yeah,
we never stopped, yes. So when we think of the use cases our customer have or network deployments require or cloud deployments require, there is a good compromise what merchant silicon provides. Next to that, there is always that tip which you want to do to build your network, but hardware might not be able to accommodate it, or then also software and the hardware has to play together. And Cisco has a long track record in building custom ASIC and providing functionality which are unique in these custom ASICs. So that's where we are. We continued our track and brought the EX series and the 9200 series, 9300 EX and 9200 series to the market this year, I guess.
So does that mean that only very special customers would find this interesting, people who really need huge scale or something along those lines? Or is this for everyone?
I think the ASIC is for everyone.
Of course.
Of course. It fits very well from small to large, as the allocation of the necessary tables which are provided in the platforms and respectively in the ASICs are tunable or adjustable, carvable. I think carving or ASIC carving is the most common term. Now, as networks are not just per se layer 2 flat, networks are not per se just only routed. Networks might have a mixed L2, L3, require a policy in there. So there are different topologies, approaches, and then architectures to build in, which require to have flexibility in how I use the ASIC in there. Now, there was carving capabilities, or there are carving capabilities within also merchant ASICs, but certain flexibility we wanted to get not only on table carving, also on buffering and how we do pipelining for quality of service scheduling. It was not at PEAR what we like to or what we think it's necessary to be done. So that compromise was not enough. Now, as we said initially, the network deployment has different requirements. Do I want to build a switch for each of the different requirements, or do I want to build an ASIC and respectively a switch which can accommodate the multiplicity of all of these different ones? And that's where exactly Cisco BrainPower of ASICs and platform development switching comes to life.
By the way, looking at your data sheets, I've seen acronyms like ASC2, ASC3, LSE. Mm-hmm. What are those things?
Everything needs a name or an acronym.
An acronym.
it's an acronym, yes. And when we started with the Merchant Plus strategy in the 9300, we had the Network Forwarding Engine, which was, in that case, the Broadcom Trident 2. And we had the ASC and the ASC2, which is the Cisco complementary ASIC, which made ACI possible, which made VXLAN routing possible, and all of these things. Now, in the meantime, we moved forward, and we have the Cisco Cloud Scale ASICs, and that's where the LSE family of ASICs come in. So the 9200, 9300EX are based on that LSE ASIC itself.
So ASC is the add-on that was used together with Trident in the older 9000 series?
Primarily, yes. That's correct. Yes.
And LSE is the new stuff?
Correct. LSE is the completely custom ASIC only, or Cisco ASIC only, which we're using in the 9200, 9300EX switches.
Yes. You mentioned table carving before. And before we go into the details, I guess it's worth explaining the broad ideas how these things work. People usually call that unified forwarding table.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what you see in data sheets of all the vendors that use the chipset from the same manufacturer.
Yes.
Who doesn't want to publish the specs, so we have to reverse engineer what they're doing. And oh, by the way, thank you for all the great Cisco Live presentations where you actually spill some of the beans.
Very welcome. I guess we can reference to that presentation so people could also get a little
bit. Oh yeah, I'll add that into the show notes.
Perfect.
So what's the unified forwarding table stuff all about?
Okay, so when we think years back, and it still applies mostly, when we want to store routes, for example, we need to have a prefix and a suffix, or at least the network object and the route in there. And with the flexibility of the mask or the sitter notation you have, you need to have a very intelligent kind of memory which can accommodate this and also parses it in a very, very fast way. And that's what we call the TCAM. In these TCAMs, the spaces are pretty limited very often, and they're also very expensive when we use this kind of memory. So when we think of using only TCAM-based systems for storing these routes, but the majority of my objects I have don't actually need a mask there or a notation in addition there, we actually waste very, very expensive resources, which we could use differently.
Okay, so which objects wouldn't need a mask?
What's one of the most common objects, which is not that common in a routing table, but doesn't need a mask, is actually the MAC table, or the MAC entry itself, which is commonly a /48 when we look at this. The other piece is what we call host routes. Host routes /128 or /32. If we know it's a host route, and respectively, when we think of MAC plus host IP equals ARP table entries, then we don't need to store masks. As we know, it's either IPv4, IPv6. We have the mask already predefined there, or it's a MAC itself. So these kind of entries actually don't need to use that very expensive TCAM part. We can actually use a hashing table for that.
Okay, so what's the difference between TCAM and the hashing table?
Very, very, very simple. TCAM has the ability to store information more widely and then respectively allow a very specific lookup. The hashing table is just going through what is my entry and search through it. I don't want to say sequentially, but in an easier way to access through these.
Okay, TCAMs have the don't care bits.
Yes.
The hash tables don't.
Pretty much this way, yeah. Yes.
And for people who really want to know how the things work, we have the hash function, which maps the value into some index. And then you go there, and you, if you find the right value at the right place, you go like, oh, I have a hit. Otherwise, it's, I have a miss.
Exactly. It's a 1-0 kind of operation there versus a longer prefix match, which we sometimes also call the classic routing lookups in the TCAMS LPM, to not only have a first match, it has to be a very specific match, which is the longest.
For talking about routing lookups, there are two ways of doing that. TCAM is one of the ways, where you just enter the routing entries with the don't care bits. And the other way that is used in high-end routers are the trees where you walk down the binary or N-ary tree and then find the entry or not.
Yes.
Just so that someone won't write a comment saying, oh, you forgot about the trees.
Yes, so there are various ways how we can do certain lookups. And I think with the CloudScale ASICs, we also did something very unique in how we store information, not per se in TCAM for that longest prefix match or for the longest prefix lookup you just mentioned in here. So we think we found a way how we can leverage hash entries. Let's call it correlate these hash entries. And if you want to go and see it a little bit more visually, we have some of these slides in the Cisco Live session you referred to. With this approach of, let's say, pivoting mask or tier entries versus host entries, we're able to scale in this exactly cloud scale kind of approach where these clouds, the ASICs go, and also allow a much more efficient carving of entries out of these different tables and present them in different use cases.
Yeah, let's go into the details of that one. And anyone who wants to know even more can go to the Cisco Live presentation.
Okay, let me do a little bit of a detour in why it's even relevant to carve.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And then let's see if we can go a little bit into these use cases where we actually see that we can improve the scale there. If I have a layer 2 switch, I need a MAC table. If I have a layer 2, layer 3 switch where I have the demarcation of this respective node, what I need there is a MAC table, obviously for the layer 2 portion there, but I also need to have ARP entries for storing the information of the end hosts and map it to the IP addresses, and respectively, we also need a routing table to go further. Now, modern networks, these L2, L3 can be distributed, and therefore we also need something like a routing table for that, which we call the host route table. So part of this hashing there, and then subsequently, we want to do summaries maybe as well. That's where the classic TCAM comes into it and the longest prefix match itself. So depending on how I built my network, there's another need, which table needs to have the according size. So the easiest way is just have one table, and that single table we have, the hashing table, we can carve and say we need a lot of mechanisms. Entries because we don't have any IP on this, so we use only the MAC hash table portion of it, and so we want to carve that very large. If we have also ARP entries there, and we also want to receive routes, host routes from a remote, we might need a little bit more in the IP area for this. And then there's also dependencies on if you're doing IPv4 and IPv6, depending on how many entries you want to store there, and vice versa. There is actually one table we haven't talked about at all, which is the adjacency table, which is another table which is pretty important depending on how I do my L2, L3, and where do I place it in order to scale the networks. So I want to have a layer 2 switch. I don't care on ARP entries. So give me a lot of MAC entries in my hashing table. So give me a profile, give me a way, give me a template how I can carve a lot of MAC out there. And that's what we actually did in the CloudScale ASICs and provided that. The other piece is a more balanced approach when I want to have an aggregation switch where I need L2, L3. So there we want to have these portions being equally exposed there, and then respectively also have some routing entries in that presence available. So, and yes, that's how you actually get a lot of these different templates. And I think we ship right now 4 templates. Some of them are very optimized to be centralized gateways versus distributed gateways versus L2 and also versus L3 for the classic routed L3 fabrics in there.
Also, it's like the SDM template on the catalyst switches.
We could say it's like the SDM templates. We could think of that, but it's very, very specific to what we did with the CloudScale ASICs and what we make available in there. And also this approach which we have in there, how we carve items out, it's quite different than what we did on the templates back in the times on the catalyst, or still today on the catalyst.
Oh, by the way, do you still have to reload the box to change the carving?
Well, let's look at it from another side. If I have a switch which is layer 2 only, and I carved it out to use only layer 2 entries, and suddenly I have the idea to place a layer 3 gateway on top of it, somehow I have to carve out these resources. if there is no space left, how do I do it? So I think the reboot approach, which we did back in the time to recarve these entries, it's still a valid approach. on the
What a long way of saying yes.
No, it's I don't want to say per se yes, because this is something which can be altered depending on the respective need of the customers, but definitely changing hardware entries. We could also think of changing a virtual machine's memory or CPU allocation. There are some implications, which is everything which is stored somewhere needs to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It can be very unexpected what the result could be there. So I think, as I said, it could be a valid approach. Or I think it's still a valid approach to do a reload, but it's not tied to that, let's say it this way.
Okay. When I was looking at, for example, your Cisco Live presentation explaining how you used the TCAM of Trident 2 chipset, for example, it has this 8 or so fixed banks, and you can assign MAC entries to so many banks and host routes to so many banks, and longest prefix matches to so many banks. And you said that now with the CloudScale ASICs, you can do carving a little bit differently. So what are you guys doing?
Okay, so very small correction. The presentation is actually from two of my colleagues, Mike Herbert and Eddie Tan, which presented that back in Cisco Live Las Vegas and even before. They're going through the whole architecture story of the platform and also look a lot at that, the differences, how we use buffers within the 9300, which is another very, very interesting discussion there. Yes, now back to the respective carving approach. Within the CloudScale ASICs, we're using, a tile approach. And if you're able to concatenate or correlate different tiles, where each of the tile has a certain amount of entry in itself, then we can do that bank chaining, which is more in the traditional way, as you mentioned before, the couple of banks we had available, which required us to do quite a lot of entries when we wanted to carve that. The tile approach gives us just much more flexibility. So let's think of, let's say a tile gives me 10 MAC entries as an example. I can separate these 10 MACs and say I want 5 host route entries and I want 5 MAC entries. So I can do that into the tile. But if I need more of this kind of specific table space, I go and get the next tile and say, I need also 5 and 5. So I just got 10. Great, right? That just doubled my approach by concatenating the tiles together. And I can go on and on and on and on and do it respectively all over these different tiles until I used the respective slice of the ASIC, which is responsible for the forwarding part of these ports up there. So that's, I think, that's what we think is a much more elegant approach than having saying, okay, you had 100K max. Oh, you need 101. I don't care. You have to take 200. Not that it is generally this way all across all the vendor ASICs which are out there, but I think having more specific entities like these tiles and being able to bank them or chain them together in a more flexible way is much more seamless and much more use case specific to the customer.
Yeah, those things aren't exactly granular.
Well, which one? The banks or the tiles?
Banks.
Well, yes. I mean, there is always a level of how much memory I have available on one of these banks and respectively how much memory I have available on such a tile, which respectively, when we turn it around, is amount of entries of certain regions which we can use. Mm-hmm. And of course, we need some more than just a 5 MAC entry and a 5 route entries. We might also have, as we previously said, adjacency. I might need some buffer for QoS or for generally buffering there. Or I mean, I need a policy and ACL space for when I want to bring down the policies. And when we look at what LSC is able to do with this flexibility and with this scale which we have present, and look on the other side, what we do on the software innovation with ACI and the policy construct itself, I think it's a perfect pairing of having a very capable switch with a capable ASIC in there, which gives me the flexibility, and then have the software on top of it, which can leverage all of these different entries and bring much more efficiency in the network for the, again, sorry to say, respective use cases of the customer. That's where we want to go.
By the way, you mentioned QoS before. Mm-hmm. And you said that you can do more on the QoS side now with the new ASICs. So
yes.
What goodies did that ASIC bring to the table?
Oh, it brings a lot of good things. It brings a lot of changed things. first of all, the architecture of the buffering is now more in a shared egress model versus what most of the former platforms we had in the data center were, which was ingress-based and then respectively VOQ-based. So with the essence of that shared buffer architecture we have in there, we can much more flexibly allocate buffer to where we really need it. Is it for some incast or burst environments?
So shared egress model means that all the buffers are available to all the output ports.
It's depending on the slices and respectively the ports, but yes, this is pretty much the case, yes. There are a couple of more intelligent pieces in there. What we are doing in not only just the classic scheduling part and buffering part. We also have some NERD knobs in there, actually built-in NERD knobs in there, which has the ability to understand on what kind of flows they are. We tend to talk about these elephant and the mice flows, and specifically when we have shared infrastructure components, an elephant could block a mice versus a lot of mice could block an elephant. And what we want is a fair treatment depending on the classification in also these shared objects. And there we have some magic in there. And personally, don't want to go into that right now because we would actually spend about an hour just in this. But there is something good. We actually recorded a couple of YouTube videos where we specifically explain why this shared approach makes sense, why we don't want to have a switch, which is a storage entity, meaning having huge buffers where you want to store files in there. It's still a switch, right? It's not a storage enclosure. And then also how we do with the available buffering we have, that optimization with the elephant mice idea, and also the dynamic allocation of these resources.
By the way, now that you mentioned the elephants and the mice, do you have any special tricks how you recognize them, or do I still have to mark them externally with the SCP bits or something?
So we have a way to dynamically identify pieces within the ASIC on where they go. I mean, we have some long-lived TCP sessions, for example, which are some indicators which go in there. But there's a lot of little intellectual property in there how we are doing this, and we could probably do some additional discussion of that just on this. I remember doing for our partners some while ago a session on what we are able with the CloudScale ASICs in regards just of QoS, of buffering and detection of flows, scheduling, and what is different than what we did before. And when we came out of that session, just to give the result rather than give all the details, it was kind of a, oh, buffering is actually something I only want to do when it's really necessary. So before I drop, yes, it's okay to buffer, but always keep in mind what you want is your application stuff delivered in time as fast as possible. So the big buffer means
long latency.
I share or store things in my switch. So again, it's not a storage appliance. And small buffer means I have to drop earlier. So it's about the right amount of buffer in the right amount of time when I need it in order to accommodate the different flows which are in the network itself.
Okay, so to oversimplify, hey guys, it's the networking switch, buy more bandwidth, not more memory.
Pretty much. When we look at non-blocking network fabrics, I don't think that buffering is per se an issue if the architecture is respectively designed right. I'm not saying that you guys out there are all doing it wrong, but the world has changed a little bit from much low bandwidth application to very high bandwidth, a lot of conversations going in there. And on the other side, we need to have the opportunity to store pieces, but not general. When we look at large buffer platforms, which are existing out there, they have niche where they are needed, and that's where they're actually respectively placed.
Yeah, like the WAN edge, where you go from very high bandwidth to reasonably low bandwidth, let's put it this way.
Correct. Speed changes is the place there. And then there is the question, is the speed change from 10 gig to 40 gig or 40 to 10, is this the right place? Specifically, if I have a multitude of 10 gigs aggregating in still a very little oversubscribed 40 gig or 100 gig within the network, or is there additional also latency in the game? As you explained from the Vantage, we might also have tremendously latency changes being in there next to the speed changes.
Yeah, if you go from 100 to 10 or 1, then you add latency, then you need buffers.
That's exactly correct. That's where the fun goes then, when we need a little bit more buffer in there within the data center, where we mostly rely on pretty short distances and high bandwidth. We tend to be able to accommodate it with a much smaller buffer size than these edge boxes out there.
Any other goodies you built into this ASICs?
Oh, we built so many goodies in there. I mean, it's tremendous to see what the team did when we look at the evolution, which just happened all over it. And let's take the size of the transistors, for example. It's such a huge step we did from very, very recently 40 nanometer to 28, and the cloud scale ASIC being on 16 nanometer right now. I think that's, I would say, that's a leap ahead of what currently the industry is basically doing. So that's more of a nerd feature of the platform rather than a function itself.
Okay, so let me ask you this question. Why should I care about that?
You should care, as we're able to do much, much more with better power efficiency at a smaller size footprint overall with much, much more bandwidth. That's the essence in there. And with this, as we are actually leapfrogged one generation ahead with the cloud scale ASICs, we're also able to do much, much more in future. And we will see that. So I think that Moore's Law, it's definitely one of the things which we could keep in mind, that we want to double capacities or triple, quadruple capacities over time. And also not only increasing this, but also shorten the time when these innovations and these excessive capabilities are coming available. I think footprint is key, power is key, capacity is key. And that's what we all try to do with that custom ASIC at an efficient pace.
To summarize, with smaller transistor size, you get higher bandwidth, more functionality at the same or lower footprint and with a lower power budget.
I should stop at marketing and let you do the job.
No, I'm just summarizing.
Very well said. That's the key essence in there. And we saw similar approaches happened years ago on the CPU side, computing CPUs. We will see similar approaches on the switching ASIC side. And I don't know if anyone looked at how long it took normally to bring a new platform out. It was like an 18 months to 2 year journey. And when we look at when we start with 9300 with the ASC and the NFEs, so the Merchant Plus strategy, and then move to the LSC, that was not 18 months. And you guys will expect some more innovation coming on the switching side in a much shorter time frame on our cloud scale ASIC series or generation.
So you're telling me that I will have to update my presentations on data center fabric switches every year?
You will have to do some more work. Yes.
Okay.
Definitely, there will be some items which are updated, but there is also that sense of a switch has a certain function to do for accommodating the transport from the user to the application or application to storage and the respective subcomponents of it. Now, do I have to change my network every 6 months or every 12 months just because the name of the switch changes or the type of the switch changes? No, it's not. In the end, it has to accommodate the use case and leverage and provide the features you're requiring. Data sheet wise or technology geeky stuff, that will change over time, but there is always a common pace where we accommodate the feature and use cases across multiple of these generations.
Let's wrap it up right here.
Let's do it.
Thank you. If someone wants to know more about this stuff,
yes,
where should they go?
Okay, so the first place to go is...
Your email.
Oh, yeah, come to my email. That's perfect. Send me hundreds of them. I will try to do my elephant and mice flow analytics and then depend on where... No, joke aside. So one good place is ciscolife.com. We have a huge set of sessions up there, and there is one specifically which is the Nexus 9000 architecture session, highly recommended. And as said, Eddie Ten and Mike Herbert did a tremendous job in explaining that from all the different angles in all the history of the 9K and even former platforms like the Cat 6K or the Nexus 7000 in there. So you will have a lot of fun there. We have a huge amount of blogs out there. We actually did a blog series with some YouTube videos in regards of why cloud scale ASICs and how we do the buffering, the queuing, and so on and so forth. So that's a good place to go there as well. Blogs@cisco.com there. And then send emails to Ivan.
Okay, I can take that.
Let's send us emails or let's ping us on Twitter.
So how do people find you on Twitter?
I'm one of these new CCIEs. So I'm not yet suspended like my other colleagues in the meantime. I'm a
suspended emeritus.
Suspended emeritus means emeritus, so that's appreciated. No, it's at CCIE21921. So I just made it before we went into the 30,000. And yeah, you can find me on Twitter with that handle there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ivan. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Software Gone Wild. If you want to learn more about software-defined networking, network automation, and related topics, visit sdn.ipspace.net and explore our courses, books, webinars, and podcasts.